Hey guys, it's DJ. When I was working at Scratch, there was nothing more fun to work on than Adventures in Golf. As you guys know, season two is rolling out now. This week's episode takes us to Bandon. Go check out Eric and his crew running around there playing all four courses in one day. It's a ton of fun. Go check it out.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. We're down here in Jupiter, Florida. We've got Tron, we've got DJ here, and we're joined by the 2018 United States Ryder Cup captain, Jim Furyk. Jim, how are we doing?
Great. How y'all?
Doing well. Have you ever done a podcast before?
I have.
You have?
I have, yeah.
You the Callaway one or the...
A number of them along the way, but I guess probably 5 years ago, someone had to explain to me what a podcast was.
So let's get the... Let's talk injury first. I know we want to hear kind of an update on what your timeline is. When the timeline of the injury, where you are now, what that means for your future, and what does that look like at the moment?
I can answer most of that. You know, the injury really started at the U.S. Open. Playing in the third round, I hit it into some long rough on 14 and decided to kind of have a go at it about 120 yards from the green. Felt like I could carry some trouble and get it up there on or around the green, and made a real hard swing at a ball on some heavy rough, and the club just shut down at impact. And, you know, you put all that force into it with your body, and I kind of felt, you know, a jab back in my shoulder and kind of ran a little bit down my collarbone. And since then, you know, I tried to play through it and started out just being a little bit sore. It wasn't that hard to play through it. And then it just progressively got worse. And by the time I got to the PGA, I really wasn't able to create any speed in my golf swing. I was in a lot of pain. And, you know, trying to play the PGA Tour at 70-80% is difficult. You know, you got so much talent, so many guys out there that have the opportunity to go low each and every day. And if you're not feeling well, you don't feel 100%. It's tough to compete, and I kind of, you know, had to look in the mirror and say I can't do it right now. And since then, I've kind of been struggling to get back to healthy. You know, seen a few doctors, seen some confused looks on trying to figure out what was wrong, and was going through kind of therapy a little bit to try to get back to 100%, and went through a period again where after a therapy session. Again, a lot of pain and soreness, but I think because of that, I learned a lot more about the injury and feel like my doctors and I have a pretty good hold on what's going on. So I'm going to go back through therapy and hope to be like January 1, kind of ramping up and getting ready for a season again. So, you know, we're sitting right now in early November. I need about, you know, a good 6-7 weeks of you know, going back through that therapy program and rehab. And if I can get through that fine, which I'm hopeful and I believe I can, I think I'll be good for January 1.
So have you touched a golf club? And
not much.
No.
Not much. The shots have been hitting. I was at a doctor out in Vail, and they had a little biomechanics lab, and I hit some shots for that, hoping that, you know, maybe it would help. I made about 10 or 12 swings there, and then I made about 10 or 12 swings off the Eiffel Tower for the Ryder Cup promo, and that was the whole, do you think you can, you know what, if it's the Eiffel Tower, I'll get it done. That's pretty cool promotion. So I chipped some 6 irons off there and had a lot of fun with Thomas.
Sometimes does that help you just to have that time away from golf, or that time away from the clubs to kind of reset?
I'm used to it. Early in my career, I played a lot. I traveled a lot around the world after the PGA Tour season was over. And once Tabitha and I started having children, and I wanted to slow down a little bit my schedule. And then as the kids got older and, you know, the winters, they were playing ball and sports, and it gets harder and harder to miss and be away from your family. And so I identified the time really in that November, December, January was going to be the time where I really got away from the tour. So for about the last 5, 6, 7 years, I've spent 3-4 months away from the tour throughout the winter months, been at home, and really haven't had a club in my hand a lot during those times. Maybe some club testing, you know, with Callaway, maybe a tournament here or there, but each and every year I've gone for 4 and 6 weeks at a time without even picking my clubs up and then getting back to it. So this year with the injury, I shut my season down a little bit early, but it doesn't feel much different than any other year, other than I know in my heart I'm not 100% healthy. But it for me, mentally, it's good to refresh, get away. And then, you know, January comes around. I'm kind of anxious and hungry to get out there and practice and get ready.
The Eiffel Tower thing kind of reminds me. We were talking, you know, before you got in, just what it's like to captain in Europe versus the U.S. I know you don't have a great sense to compare the two, but I'm curious, other stuff like that, was there anything that's been kind of wild about having to kind of promote yourself on a different continent and do all that stuff over there? Or is it, what's that been like for you?
You know, it's been a fun process. I think I'm usually really comfortable going to the press room, media. I actually usually enjoy that process. I've got a lot of friends in the media and always felt, I guess I start out kind of as a duty. I mean, it was my job to go into the press room, give them a story, give them something to talk about. And if I felt like if I did a good job doing that, it would reflect on me, and they'd do a good job covering kind of me and what I do for a living. And I've always had that great relationship. I was nervous to go to Paris. I mean, you're kind of going to foreign soil. You know, you feel like you go into Ryder Cups, and I didn't want to say anything that maybe could stoke a fire. I mean, we know their fans are great. We know they're loud.
No bulletin board material.
Yeah, no bulletin board material. But really, you know, it was uncharted waters. I really hadn't done that before. And usually when I walk into a press room, I'm representing myself, you know, my brand. And here I'm representing our country and an entire team and the PJ of America. And so it felt like a lot of weight on my shoulders, but I kind of eased into it and felt pretty comfortable after a while. So it's been a great process. It's been a lot of work, but it's been a lot of fun work.
I was going to say, does the captaincy kind of help take your mind off the fact that you had this downtime with the injury? I mean, you're keeping yourself plenty busy.
Oh, I've been busier than ever. The Ryder Cup's kept me busy. My wife and I are building a home in Jacksonville, Florida. So the new home is going to be ready here in the next month or two.
Me and Tron should look at buying your old place. Maybe.
That's good. There you go. There you go. It may be for sale in about a year or so. Yep.
All right, we'll start saving up.
There you go. So that's kept me busy. And I've got a 13 and a 15-year-old at home, right. So that in itself is busy. So it's a rude awakening when all of a sudden, man, I'm starting to think my 15-year-old, like, I don't know, in 3 years she's going to be in college.
So are you doing the learner's permit thing right now?
We are doing the learner's permit thing right now.
Mildly terrifying?
I've ducked a few times, so I just say that. I might put a hole in the floorboard on the passenger side because there's a couple times I want to hit the brake and it's not really there. But she's a pretty good driver. She's the cautious one in the family. You know, the kids both ski, and they're both really good skiers. She's the one that's cautious, mindful, uses her head. She drives the same way. My 13-year-old boy, that could be – he's aggressive. So that could be interesting. When a year and a half from now when he has his permit, I'm gonna be nervous.
Ponte Vedra is a good place to learn to drive.
It is.
Pretty low-key.
Except for A1A.
Except for – yeah, you can get rear-ended by some sleepy people behind.
A1A has a – few places where people go too fast, especially in like that South Ponte Vedra. Yeah, you get sure. Down south of there. Yeah, it's a good spot. I love living there. I've been there now for over, I think, for 21 years.
What brought you guys there? I'm just curious, kind of all the spots you can
pick. You know, early in your career, I was a nomad. I mean, I basically was a gypsy living out of my car for the first couple of years playing mini tours and the web.com tour. So yeah, I look back, I left school and I graduated in 92. That summer I played some mini tour events out of the trunk of my car. I went back in the fall to Arizona to graduate. It took me 4.5 years and went through tour school as well. And I got a conditional card on the web. And from there it was kind of, you know, back home in Pennsylvania for Christmas, back to Arizona, working on my game, getting ready. And I grabbed the car and I started in Yuma, Arizona. I had that car in Florida. I had it in the state of Maine. I had it back to Texas. I got that car all the way up to state of Washington.
What kind of car was it?
Time. It was a Pontiac Bonneville.
Oh, the best.
And all I wanted to make sure is that it had cruise control. That was the most important thing. But, I mean, that car hit four corners in a year and a lot of fun. But I never really had a home, to be honest with you. I'd be in Arizona for the winter. I'd be in Pennsylvania for the summer, the two places I grew up and went to school. And then when I kind of established myself on the PGA Tour my rookie year, I started looking for a place to live. And Mark Carnevale was a young player on tour, and he had just moved to Ponte Vedra. He was telling me about a townhouse he bought there, about the cost of living, the Prax facility. And I was looking at buying a townhouse back home in Pennsylvania that – was almost twice the cost. Taxes were higher. Weather wasn't as good. And then I had TPC at the practice facility in Ponte Vedra. I kind of said, well, this is crazy. And during the Masters that year, I went to Ponte Vedra, stayed at the Marriott there at Sawgrass. My parents came down to visit, and they helped me look for a place to live, and ended up buying a townhouse there. So I've been there ever since for 21 years.
And the Jags. I mean, the Jags had to be a big selling point.
I was trying to get him hyped up on the Jags on the way here. He wasn't
Steelers
taking it.
Fans.
He's big
Steelers fan. I'm a Steelers fan. The Jags wore the Steelers out earlier this year. It's a sore point. I think there's only like two or three teams in the league that Steelers have a lifetime losing record to it, and Jacksonville's one of them, which is crazy.
There's only one or two teams in the league that the Jags have a winning record against as well, probably.
It's probably not that bad, but...
So what you brought that up, that just the mini tour life and whatnot, and I think that's kind of the part when you can look back at your career. That's probably not what somebody would focus on. But what do you remember most about those days? And what's the funding like in that when you're initially getting started? Do you have sponsors that are helping fund your travel? And because the prize money is not there.
We raised some money. I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We raised some money with some folks at the club I played at, some friends of the family. So we probably raised close to $20,000. Which now doesn't sound like a lot of money, but I'm very thankful the folks that lent me money to go out and play. At the end of the year, they weren't trying to make money, you know, which is usually, you know, you have a contract where kid goes out, maybe his sponsors raise $50,000, he travels on that for the year, but for every dollar he makes, you know, he may give back 75% of the first 50 to 100,000, and then that number keeps dropping. And I've heard stories where even Payne Stewart, it took him years.
Yeah, I remember
to
reading
get out from underneath his
Blood,
sponsors.
Sweat, and Tease about Rich Beem, like, you know, I think it was El Paso Country Club or whatever. Like, all those guys got together and gave him money, and then he ended up winning the Kemper, and they ended up forgiving his debts and all that. But like, that was a big deal. Otherwise, he was going to owe, you know, like 75% of that winner's check to them.
Right.
So.
And I was lucky. At the end of the year, I gave back the money. There was one gentleman that wouldn't even let me give back, you know, whatever, $7,500. So, you know, I always feel indebted to those folks, and they were real close friends of the family. A couple of those folks, you know, if anything ever happened to mom and dad, they would be the guys I would lean on for advice and kind of being a surrogate father. So my grandmother also, when she worked for Gannett for the newspaper, and every check she put $25 away for her grandchildren. So I had close to $15,000 when I graduated from college that we threw into that pool as well. So I'll never forget what grandma did. And she used to tell me when I was a kid that she was throwing these, you know, putting them in the CD and putting it here, putting it there, and we're saving money. And you know, when you're 8 years old, you're like, oh, okay, you know, great. But it was really cool that almost accounted for half the money that we had raised. So, you know, I wasn't a kid that came out of college where anyone expected, you know, there wasn't any agents knocking on the door. My first year out, I was playing Tommy Armour Golf Equipment. My dad worked for Tommy Armour Golf. He was a sales rep. My dad was an ex-club pro. So no one was knocking on the door. No agents, no club companies, no ball company. I really, you know, I had a decent, I was All-American a couple of times. I had a decent college career, but I was a kid with a goofy swing, and I played okay. I didn't have a very good amateur career and turned pro. And so I needed kind of the mini tours. I needed a web.com tour. I needed a place to kind of grow at my own rate. I think one of the things I feel almost bad for some of the kids coming out of college, I feel great for them that, you know, they're going to sign with a company, they're going to make a little money, but it puts so much pressure on them. And folks mm-hmm. expect everyone to be the next Jordan Spieth and someone that matures at an ultra rapid pace. And so the expectation sometimes on these young kids is difficult, you know, and that it's not their expectations, it's outside expectation. And sometimes it's hard for a 20-year-old to deal with that. And they're not allowed to improve at their own rate. And I think kind of back to maybe even someone that came out maybe a little untouted, like Ben Curtis had the same thing. He went and won the British Open so early, and I'm sure he wouldn't trade it for the world, but then they expected him to be a major champion.
Yeah.
And heck, I had never heard of Ben Curtis when he won that tournament, and I was on tour. So, you know, he's a great guy, and it took him a while, but he matured into a great player, won more golf tournaments. But stuff like that was hard for young players, and I had never was dealt that card. I was always dealt the, you know, no one under the radar, no one looking my way. I was able to improve at my own rate. And when I did gain some success as a young tour player, and by the time I won my first event, I was prepared for it, if that made sense. You know, I felt confident in who I was on tour and that I belonged and that I could back it up. And by the time I won the major championship in 03 and people identified that as a life-changing experience, I really felt like, well,
you've been building up to it for a long time.
I'd build up to it. It was my seventh win. I felt like, you know, I was ready for that. And it changes things, but it wasn't a life-altering experience for me from that perspective.
That's insane. That so 2000, that was Ben Curtis won the Open that year, I think,
it
right?
It was, yeah.
Can you imagine another time when the defending U.S. Open champion has never heard of the next major champion? That's insane.
I didn't know who Ben was. He was in his rookie year.
No, of course.
Nobody did.
He played well, I think, at maybe
was it like fourth alternate or something?
He played well at maybe like in Chicago that year and earned enough money to squeak into the field. So and when he won the tournament, I honestly never met this guy.
Oh, totally.
That he won again on tour after that and kind of validated.
Shout out to the Booz Allen Classic.
Yeah.
He won in Texas too, didn't he?
He won probably three or four times in his career and turned into a real solid Ryder Cup player, turned into a real solid player. But
Ryder Cup? Was he really?
Yeah, he played the Ryder Cup in 08 when we won.
Oh, that's right.
Think of it, he's 1-0. I mean, he might have the secret.
that's what we've been
might
missing.
Might have to tap into this.
Future captain.
Yeah, make a call.
Who are your assistant captains?
Right now, Davis Love has been named.
Okay.
So, and we'll probably, I'm not sure when the PGA of America, what time they have in mind. I have some guys obviously in mind that, and I'm allowed to name five vice captains. So okay. I'd expect maybe in January or February, we'll name two or three more.
Hey, Tron, the holiday season's coming up soon. What are you doing for the holidays?
Oh man, it is coming up. I'm going to Australia. Play some golf.
I am too. This is your first ad read, by the way, isn't it? I am too. Why don't you tell us a bit about the holiday gift guide that Callaway, our friends at Callaway have?
Well, we could probably use some of these. It's some Chrome softballs, the ball that changed the ball, $31.99 plus free personalization on the website.
Anyone use that ball that we know?
Jim Furyk, who we're actually sitting with right now.
He's making faces at us as we record
shot
this.
Shot 58 with it.
Go to CallawayGolf.com/gift guide. Stock up on these. Take advantage of the great offer while it lasts. Chrome Soft, the ball that changed the ball. Now let's get back to our conversation with Jim Furyk.
It's actually a really good deal.
It is a very good deal. Well, that's a good transition because I've got a myriad of things I want to ask about the Ryder Cup.
He's kind like obsessed.
I'm a big Ryder Cup guy. Right. So I want to go back to 14.
Like go through like Q&A like you're going to test my knowledge.
No. It's not a trivia
1923.
Question. Samuel Ryder. So I want to go back to 14 at the press conference. I didn't look up the exact quote, but you famously said something along the lines of, if it was up to me, I would have changed this shit a long time ago. You're now the captain for the 18 team. So has this shit changed?
Did I say that?
Yeah.
I said that in the press conference?
Yeah.
I was probably trying to avert any attention that was going the other way during that press conference.
Look over here.
If you looked at the tape of that press conference, I was sitting to the camera's far right, as far right as I could get. If they'd have let me sit off the stage, because I've been in, you know, my biggest regret really in my whole career is the Ryder Cup's my favorite event. It is the greatest sporting event in golf, in my opinion. And so for me to go into nine of those as a player and have those teams come out 2-7, so losing seven times is my biggest regret. And I've sat in that press conference so many times, and you know, the questions are coming up and they're, you know, starting to point fingers, and we've stayed pretty unified as a team for the most part. And it just, I'll be honest, it sucks to be up there and to lose and then to immediately, because the losing team, you go right to the closing ceremonies and then they march the losing team right into the press. So you haven't really had a lot of time to digest what just happened. You sit on the stage and you go through the ceremony and one team's happy and one team's not. It's uncomfortable. And then you walk over to the press and, you know, and it starts. And so, you know, it used to be Tiger and Phil were on all those teams and they were going to answer 90% of the questions, right? They're going to ask Tiger the first question. They're going to follow up with Phil, the captain, the rest of us. I mean, I used to say, honestly, I could sit on the one side of the stage, probably pick my nose and no one would notice.
Let's try that.
We're walking into the press room and I'm looking around and I said, well, you know, Phil's here. And I'm looking at all the guys on the team, and I said, oh, no. Like, you know, I've played 8 or 9 of these now, and
I'm the guy now.
I'm going to get the second question. I know it's coming. I mean, I know it's coming. And so they lead in with Tom, and, you know, he talks about disappointment and we didn't win, and then they lead, you know, come to Phil, and I know I'm getting the next question. So I remember thinking, you know, I'm just over here minding my own business. And I think the quote that I made, if when you go back and read it, is we didn't have a lot of answers at the time. Right. You know, there was criticism that we weren't a team, that we weren't together, that we weren't close. Now you read the press and, you know, Jordan and Justin, and they're all buddies and they hang out off the course and everyone's tight. I mean, winning solves a lot of issues when you look at it. You know, when your football team's winning, the coach is the greatest coach in the world. And when it wasn't that long ago, Mike Tomlin was a heel, right? Now they're winning and he's the greatest coach ever. It's everyone jumps on that bandwagon as far as it's an easy story. And so, you know, for us though, as a team, we kept coming up empty and losing those events, and we were looking for answers. And so I think when the press looked and said, what's going to change it? And I was like, well, if it was that easy, we'd be winning, right? If it were that easy, we've all worked hard. We've all tried to make it better, but, you know, we keep coming out on a losing end. And so I think, you know, when we all got together in West Palm as a group, and they, you know, it was called the Task Force, the Ryder Cup Task Force, which not the best name, but I think it helped us get together as players, as past captains, as the group, as PGA of America as a whole, to kind of get together, band our thoughts together, and try to create a plan for the future, and a long-term plan for the future of what can we do in any way to help this team improve and to get better and give them the best opportunity to win. And now we've had some success. We won a Ryder Cup. We won a President's Cup. And I read the stories and, you know, it all goes back to, boy, I don't know what they talked about in that room, but, well, you know, the President's Cup team has had success for a lot of years. You know, Fred Couples ran a great ship, went to Jay Haas. They passed it down to Steve Stricker. You know, I think that would be almost a shot to them to say that the task force made us good in that event. But, you know, the Ryder Cup committee has worked hard to give the team and the captain an opportunity to succeed. And I think one thing we can't do is look and say, well, just because of those meetings, this team's playing great now. It, you know, the kids, you look at the guys that played in the Ryder Cup and the shots that were hit and the quality of not only the veteran play, but young players stepping up, like a Brooks Koepka playing in his first Ryder Cup. They've hit some great shots and they've played amazing. And you got Phil Mickelson shooting whatever it was, 52, and coming out with a halve against Sergio in one of the greatest Ryder Cup matches ever on Sunday. So the guys have played really good golf. Our job as captains, our job with the Ryder Cup committee and the PGA of America is just to be able to set an atmosphere and give the guys on the golf course every opportunity to be able to compete and to play well. And Davis did a great job both in his first time as captain and his second time as captain, is really kind of setting that atmosphere and letting the guys go out and play free. And it was fun to watch. It was fun to be there as a captain. And you know, I feel like we all felt like we had a little part in it, but I'm so proud of and happy. Really not proud is even a bad word. I'm so happy for the guys that played on that 16 team to watch them have success, because my era didn't have that much success, you know, and only 2 wins.
So, I mean, I always go back to like 12 Ryder Cup, where obviously the U.S. team didn't end up winning, but I didn't feel like that was poor leadership in any capacity. I mean, the leadership in my mind kind of goes into that team structure for the team play. When singles rolls out, other than determine the order, there's not really anything a captain can do. So I look back at that team and think there was not anything functionally wrong with that, and probably things don't get blown up if we don't lose that Ryder Cup. Do you see it that way, or is that am I thinking too far into
2012,
that?
So back at Medina.
Right. So we're up 10-6.
Well, I'll say I don't feel like I've ever played for a poor leader or that we've had poor leadership in any sense of the form. I've never played for someone where, I mean, the folks I've played for spent 2 years of their life, and now being a captain, I know how hard they worked, how hard they tried, and I've always felt like I've played for great captains, and my captaincy will be a reflection upon it. I mean, I'm going to pull bits and pieces from every Ryder Cup I played on, things that I loved about the captain and how they managed a team, and I'll pull bits and pieces from every one, and it'll be a reflection on each and every one of them. 12 was, I mean, we dominated Thursday and Friday, or Friday and Saturday. You know, we should have been. There's a chance that we could have been 5 or 6 points up going the Sunday, and it would have been over, and that we had a four-point lead. It had only been overcome once, and I was on that team in 99. We laid an egg on Sunday. Yeah. We didn't get it done. We didn't play well. They got the momentum. And as that momentum turns, you can feel it on the golf course. And I was one of those matches. I mean, I had Sergio, in my mind, beat. I was one up on 16, and he was dead and made an unbelievable up and down. I lipped out a birdie putt, and we have that hole. I lost 17 and 18, lost a match one down. I was part of that problem, and definitely probably one of the most dejected feelings, I think, as a player to walk out of there after a four-point lead on Sunday. And I guess for all the wrong reasons. I mean, I felt, as a player, I felt terrible. And then having a close friend in Davis be the captain, I felt bad for Davis as well. But one of the things you have to realize as a captain, and I mean, you're in the hot seat. I mean, no matter what, you know, the team does well. They play it up like, you know, it was a great captaincy. And I think every good captain will say, give all the credit to their team. I mean, they're the guys hitting the shots, but you have to be prepared as a captain. If the team, for one reason or another doesn't do well, you know, it's your fault. You know, you take the job knowing that. And, but the event means so much to me and has meant so much to my career. And, you know, we all want to win golf tournaments. We all want to win major championships. And for me to start at the start of every year, one of my goals was to make those teams. And one of the proudest things in my career, I guess, would be that I was able to qualify for so many of those.
What was your first one? 97?
97.
97. Valderrama.
At Valderrama. And that was a strange week with the rain. And I was, you tell every rookie that like your first Ryder Cup, the first 3 or 4 days of practice will feel like 2 weeks. And then Friday, Saturday, Sunday will like go by in 15 minutes. I mean, it flew by. I really was so green and so young, and I over practiced and I wore myself out. And then I went out and played. I mean, I did everything stereotype, what you could do wrong during a Ryder Cup week. I did it that week. I mean, without a doubt.
Showed up really early and
stayed practice too late, yeah. Rushed, you know, you don't, your whole, one of the hardest parts about the Ryder Cup is it totally flips your normal schedule. You're not on your own schedule like usual. You're on a team schedule, which is pretty easy for most people, but we're up later at night for functions and dinners and stuff we don't usually do early in the week in a normal event. And then you're up early every morning because there's really no time to sleep in until Sunday, right? Matches start early on Friday and Saturday. You have to be up early for practice because they have media schedule, they have picture scheduled, they have opening ceremony scheduled, so you've got to get your practice in early as well. You just, guys don't get a lot of rest, and that'll be one of the challenges. That's a big challenge of flying east, going over the pond, jet lag, guys are worn out, so it'll trying to manage our time well and get these guys enough rest and prepare and getting over the jet lag will be important.
Is there a week off this year?
Right after the tour championship. So
it's tough.
We'll have guys, you know, we'll meet in a hotel in Atlanta Sunday night, kind of get organized, and then we'll hop on a charter and fly. I'm imagining we'll probably, I'm trying to put the numbers together, but we'll probably arrive in Paris. We'll probably land around noon on Monday, yeah. With the time change. So,
is there a week off before the Tour Championship, or is it before BMW?
There is. Okay. So we have the 3 playoff events in a row, 1 week off, and Tour Championship. So,
what for you as the captain is like kind of the most unexpected? I don't want to say time suck because it's all valuable, it's all, you know, details that you have to kind of factor in, but what's the biggest surprise to you where you're like, man, like it took me 8 hours to choose these rain suits?
You know what, we've kind of got it, the PGA of America's got it down pretty good right now. If anything, I would say that there's times where I want to be more involved. But Polo Ralph Lauren is the clothing supplier. This is the fourth time they've done it, so you know, right now we vetted through issues, problems, you know, and you can only reinvent red, white, and blue so many ways. So it's a tough challenge for them to make the clothes look sharp. And, you know, They've been doing it now. This is 4 times. So they've had to come up with 29 different red, white, and blue shirts by this point. But
there was no thought.
I guess nothing's been a giant surprise. I enjoy, like, at home, I have a little golf tournament in Jacksonville for some friends that about four or five of us host. And so we each do a little bit. Like, I make t-shirts and hats, and it's kind of like gifts for everyone.
I love seeing those t-shirts around town.
We make logos.
I've got a hand-me-down. It's like the best t-shirt I have, by the way.
So we have, whatever we have fun with it. I like designing the hat. I like doing that part of it. So, we've designed the hats for the Ryder Cup. The clothing's pretty much done. I did the media. And right now, I'm just kind of more in the collecting data. I just came back from a really cool, the PGA of America had their annual meetings in Austin, Texas, and they invited me to come out. And they had, they were trying to get all six Ryder Cup captains that live in Texas. And Jackie Burke wasn't well enough to make it, but I had Lee Trevino, Lanny Watkins, Hal Sutton, Tom Kite, Ben Crenshaw, all up on stage. And I sat in the back like a little kid and watched, and they talked about their Ryder Cup experiences. And then after about an hour, they invited me up on stage for like the last 30 minutes. And I got to sit up there and talk about being a captain. And, it's just an honor. I mean, I've said this a million times, but I started playing for Tom Kite and Ben Crenshaw. So two folks that I wanted to emulate, that I looked up to, that I watched when I was a kid, and they were my first captains. And then as I grew, you know, through with Curtis Strange, and then it went to Hal Sutton, who I played against, and Paul Azinger, and all of a sudden it became like the folks that I played against. Yeah. Then you had Davis Love, and I'm like, all right, here's one of my friends. You know, it's almost my age. And so it was kind of a nice, fun growing experience. But to spend that time with the past captains and hear their ideas and how the Ryder Cup's changed so much and blown into this massive event, and to hear them talk about it was really cool.
So in the way you described it, it doesn't sound like a ton actually ended up changing about the process and the captaincy. I mean, is that accurate to say?
Well, I think there was a couple key points. We talked about how we were going to identify captains in the future, what was important. I don't know. There wasn't like a list made that here's what we're going to do for the next 4 or 5 years. But the idea was, one of the important things I came out with it was, we're going to, one, identify the future captains, and we're going to give them some experience. So I think one of the things we've done to the captain in the past, I think they've all done a good job, but I think they all would have liked to have probably been a vice captain to start with. And I think I might, out of the nine times I played for eight captains, maybe one or two of them had experience as a vice captain before. I think Davis was a vice for Corey, and Corey might have been a vice captain for Lehman. I can't remember, but there was only one or two that had any experience at all as a captain. They all played in a lot of Ryder Cups, but to be behind the scenes, to see the decisions that have to be made, the timing of those decisions, interaction with the team, I think is valuable. So for me to do it at the President's Cup twice, for Jay Haas and for Steve Stricker, and to also be a vice captain for Davis the last Ryder Cup, is invaluable for me. So that's one of the things we wanted to do. Two, I think we kind of developed more of a long-term plan instead of we have to win now. You know, it was kind of, the idea was let's look ahead. Let's look 10 years, 20 years into the future. What's it going to take to build? And I think any major corporation would look at their business that way. You want to be successful now, but what's going to help carry us? Let's, in the back of our mind, what's going to carry us in the next 10 Ryder Cups? And the goal would be to try to have a winning record for the next 20 years. That would be a success, especially coming off of 20 lean years where we, you know, went 2-7 or 2-8. And I guess last, a lot of it was, what's going to help the players, you know, succeed? What can we do? And the idea was, the PGA of America committed to the players and the captains. We'll do whatever it takes. And so Davis left me with some wise words that I'll never forget. When decisions are made, and especially heat of the battle, heat of the moment, or leading up to the Ryder Cup, because a lot of decisions will be made in the last couple of months, the one question he said he always asked himself was, will this help the team? You know, there's going to be a lot of chaos and a lot of noise, and you know, even picking uniforms. I mean, I want the guys to be comfortable. Will this help the team in all the decisions? So, you know, one thing as a captain we always want is, I want my players comfortable. I want them knowing exactly who they're going to be playing with. I don't want to throw them any curveballs Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. So I want there to be a nice game plan going into the Ryder Cup, right? And I don't really want to veer from that game plan too much. We'll have a, you know, A plan, a B plan, you know, and a backup plan, and I want them going in and prepare. The idea is they're going to play the Tour Championship, and someone's going to be trying to win $10 million the day that we leave for the Ryder Cup, right? I'm thankful to have that week off, the week right before the Ryder Cup. Yeah. I think that gives me a chance to talk to the guys to prepare. Who do you want to play with? Who do you think complements your game? You know, sometimes
you're
thankful
that the year you won the Tour Championship, you didn't have to go play the
Ryder Cup. I hopped right on a plane.
That was Celtic Manor.
Yeah, that was Celtic Manor. I hopped right on a plane. I never got a chance to celebrate. I think I had a beer at the hotel. We hopped on a plane, went over there, and it was like full mode, you know, right into Ryder Cup. So I know what that guy, I only know exactly how he feels. I lived it. I think Corey sat me out of the first match on Friday morning, and the idea was he wanted to give me kind of a chance, I think, to decompress. And then the plan was to go play the last three matches in the singles, and then we got the rain, and we had a session cut short. So it was everything kind of got flipped on top of itself that week. But you want the guys to really go in there comfortable, to not have any curveballs, to not have any changes, and it sounds easier than it is in the whole process. It's been a really eye-opening. And now that the President's Cup has changed and we play less matches there, we have a lot of the same issues with matching up players and when to sit, when to play. It's been a great experience for me for the last 3 years.
The President's Cup, have you kind of used that as a proving ground for some? I mean, has there been a cohesive effort?
It's good for us. I think you look at the European team and they have the they call it the Asia Cup or the
Eurasia
Cup. Yeah. So that's kind of a practice run for them. I think it also maybe some of their top players, you might not see like Justin Rose, Henrik Stenson every year in that event, but it allows them to give some of their younger players
create some depth,
but give them an idea of what's going to happen during Ryder Cup time. And it gives the captain kind of a practice run as well. So he has a year to kind of get used to some of the guys, how he's going to pair them, who may fit well, who may not. I think it's good for them. And that's what the President's Cup does for us. It gives us a chance to see personalities. We had five guys this year playing the President's Cup that had never played an international competition. So I think it was great for them to get some experience, get an idea of who they are, who they match up with, who they pair well with. Great lessons for us.
You mentioned the vice captains a little earlier. I know he's been around the last couple of times. What's vice captain Tiger like?
He has been great for the team. I think it's been a good two way for him as well. You know, Tiger's been away from competitive golf now for quite some time, and I think he misses kind of being with the guys a little bit. With, you know, we have a great camaraderie and that locker room talk and the jabs and the barbs and the sarcasm, but the camaraderie and, you know, the hugs afterwards when you know, a job well done. I think he's missed that. And it's good for him to be in that atmosphere and be back with the guys. And then we get twofold from him, you know, arguably the greatest player of all time. So not only physically, but mentally, right? We get to see kind of a strategy and a style.
That's what I was going to say. Like, what kind of stuff is he
that he brings to
this?
The table? He's good with pairings, good at maybe picking out what the other captain may or may not do. He's been an unbelievable resource for both Davis and Steve, and trying to pair up guys. And then I think you also have the other side of it. There's a lot of guys on that team, young players, that actually play golf for a living because they wanted to be the next Tiger Woods, right? So to have him in the team room, a couple of them, I think the first time I was just worried that they'd be in awe. Like, oh my God, Tiger Woods is in my team room.
Right?
He's helping me, but it turned into, it was this positive that, you know, they liked kind of giving him some barbs, but they really enjoyed having him in the team room. And, you know, they were poking at him a little bit the first year, like, hey, we want you to get healthy. We want to play against you. I mean, we grew up wanting to be you.
We want to beat you.
And you could see a couple of like me and Layman and Davis were over there going, yeah, be careful what you ask for, man. We had 15 years of getting our rear ends beat. So we're like, you know, you might not want to go that way. Just say it.
Well, that's what I'm curious about. You know, you've been a peer of his for so long now. You've probably seen him change a lot. I'm curious kind of what he, you know, seeing him in that atmosphere, has he always kind of had that side of himself, or is he as kind of closed, you know, back in the day, was he kind of as closed off as people make him out to be, or?
No, I don't think he was closed off. I think you look at Tiger when he was a young player, he was the best player in the world. It was kind of like Jordan Spieth, you know, being so young but so good and cast into that leadership role. And I think probably for Tiger, he probably felt like there was older players on the team. He didn't want to step on their toes. He didn't want to assume a leadership role when you had guys that have played in 5, 6, 7 Ryder Cups on the team. And so I think he was happy early on kind of going about his own business. And then as he grew and as he got older, and I think he started assuming that role more and more. But I think from the outside, folks looked at him a little bit, maybe viewed him as close, but he was young as well. And I think one thing that my era, you know, Mickelson, myself, Tiger, I always wanted to show respect for the players that were there before me. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to make sure that when I played on a team with Tom Lehman or I played on a team with Payne Stewart, or I mean, they were our older player, our veteran leaders. And you know, you want to help and you want to be involved and you want to be in the team room, but you also want to, you know, you want to follow their lead. They've been there. They know how to get to the end and win. So I think Tiger was doing much the same. And as he grew into that role of being a leader on the team.
What does Tiger call you? Just Jimmy? Or like, he's got like a little nickname for everybody, I guess.
He does. I guess I hear Jimmy a lot. He calls my wife Tabs a lot. He puts an S at the end of Tabs.
I love Tiger.
Instead of Tab. Tabs. Jimmy.
He adds like the IE to everything.
Yeah. You know, I guess he's called me a lot more names than that I probably couldn't repeat. But I've always taken it in an endearing way. Yeah. So we both, the one similarity we have is we're both very sarcastic. So like with my friends and people that I'm close with, I like to give them a hard time and rib them. And I think he's really enjoyed that, but he's very good at giving it back. And ultimately he's the best ever. You're going to lose eventually.
He's got the trump card no matter
yes,
what.
Yes, he does.
Always.
I mean, not only do you have this all-star team of captains, but is it safe to say Phil kind of plays a assistant, like a playing captain's role in kind of a more senior role on the team too?
He really has. He really has. And it's good to see. I think when Couples was captain, he would always, the President's Cup teams back then didn't have a lot of captains. You know, he usually had one vice captain. So the veteran players, you know, it would be like Stricker, Woods, Mickelson, Furyk, get back here. I want to talk to you. And he would lean on us as far as what do you see out there? You know, you're playing with these guys. Who's playing well? Who needs to keep playing? Is there someone that's struggling? Who do we put an arm around? Who do we need to help out? And so Phil's been in that role for quite a long time. I think, you know, you saw it with a Keegan Bradley. You saw it with some younger players. Phil tends to take, I know, even as a veteran player in 2011, I was having a terrible season. I squeaked on the, after playing so well in 10 and being player of the year, I barely squeaked on the team in 11. And the first person Phil asked for, I want to play with Furyk. And I always took that as, well, he's saying that because he thinks he'll get the best out of me. He wants to kind of put his arm around me. And I know you had a tough year, but I know what's in there. We're going to go out there and win. And we did. We went 3-0 as a team. I played, that was probably my best team event I've ever played in my career was in 2011, and really it was, you know, he gained a lot of energy out of me and was a great teammate, and he kept me loose, which was great. I think in these events, when you're young, you tend to worry about, you know, the best way I can help this team is I can go play my best golf, and you get so focused on yourself and playing well. And then as you grow into a Phil Mickelson or Tiger Woods or someone that's played on a lot of teams, you realize that it doesn't matter how well you play. You can't win it individually, right? It has to be a team effort. And you start looking around the team. You find the guy that's struggling that may have it hanging his head because of a putt. You start trying to raise the level of everyone around you. And if you can do that, you know, if everyone can try to do that and try to help their teammate, the team becomes much better for it. And then you start playing well as a team. That's when you start winning these events.
What do you guys talk about on the earpiece?
I love the earpiece.
I think Tiger loves the earpiece too.
I get criticized.
Tiger likes how the earpiece looks.
Yes. Yeah. I get criticized for my banter a little bit. I like to talk. You know, it's quiet out there. A lot of times we're by ourselves and you're not talking to your team that much. So I want to talk to someone. But you hear some jokes. I think probably my favorite thing that I've ever heard, I wasn't far behind the McIlroy Patrick Reed match at Hazeltine, but you could just hear these epic roars coming from ahead, and you knew where it was coming from. You knew it was that match. And Tiger would have to wait for like 2 minutes for everything to calm down before we could even hear him on his mic. And so, you know, he'd say, all right, you know, they both just birdied four. Reed knocked in a 10-footer. McIlroy topped with an 8-footer. Well, they got to number six and the par five, and we hear this epic roar. And it seemed like minutes before he could come on. And finally, when it quieted down, someone said, Tiger, you got to let us know what's going on up there. And he goes, you won't believe this. You know, McIlroy knocks it in from here. And he said, you know, Reed had this unbelievable putt, 15-footer. He knocked it in. He said he bowed and shushed him all at once on the way up to walking to the hole. And trying to envision that in my mind was, I got to see it on tape later, but I about fell over. I was laughing so hard. And, you know, the fans are looking at you and you feel like an idiot because I'm laughing and talking and trying to hear. And then they're, you know, if they're close, they're like, well, what did he say? So I just think the little stories, the what's going on in the golf course, what do you see? You know, every once in a while someone hits a bad shot and I'll say, all right, when you get to number six, you got to check it out. You know, look at the hot dog stand left. But someone hit it under this hot dog stand and you just got to see where it is.
You guys essentially turn into fans at that point. There's not a ton you can do during play.
No, I think really at that point, once you're out on the golf course, the vice captain really can kind of lend to the captain, hey, here's where the match stands. These guys are playing well.
These guys have a good rapport with each other right now.
They're doing well together. I think we need to send them out this afternoon. Or, you know, hey, I've got a guy here that's struggling with this game. He's missing a lot of fairways. We're probably apt to sit him this afternoon, give him a chance to practice, get him back out on the golf course tomorrow. But those decisions have to be made pretty early. Sometimes you make those at the turn, right, for one of the last groups.
Yeah.
Because the afternoon pairings have to go out. And sometimes they'll turn around now on the back nine. Something clicks, they make a bunch of birdies, they win a match, and you got to walk up to a guy and, hey, what time am I going out this afternoon? You're not. You know, we're going to sit you down and blah, blah, blah. So it, you know, a lot of it's just having a rapport with the players, giving them knowledge after the round, what's going on, are you playing, what time you're playing, let me give you a ride, let me get you ready. Having anything on that cart ready that they may need. You know, Lanny Watkins was telling a story about how Nicholas always had, like, it looked like a toolbox or something on the cart. He said it was full of just crap, but he had everything you could possibly need. And he said, I was back in the days of metal spikes, I had the spike that fell out of my shoe.
He was selling his ice cream out of there too.
It might have been. They did talk about him eating ice cream afterwards and how good Barbara could cook. But he said it was on the inside of his right shoe, and every time it was kind of wet, and every time he went to push off, he was slipping on his right foot. And he said, I walked over to Jack, and he had a pair of golf shoes on. And he said, hey, can I pull a spike out of one of your shoes and put it in my right foot? He showed me. He goes, I'm missing the spike. I'm slipping. And Nicholas just reached in the cart, and he had a spike wrench and spikes. And Lanny put his foot up, and he goes, and here I got Jack Nicklaus changing the spike in my shoe. He goes, it's just priceless. So,
Will you wear golf shoes as captain?
Sometimes I have, but you know, I wear those are the bottom of the shoes, so they're spikeless shoes. I think we're walking a lot. We're used to being in our golf shoe while we're walking, so
you don't want to get foreign.
I'll wear like a running shoe. You know, I'm Adidas guy, so with shoes, I'll wear a running shoe, or I'll wear the golf shoe that I wear on tour that kind of looks like a running shoe anyway. So, I don't know if I'd go out there with the big metal spikes and walk around, but I'm on my feet so much, and a lot of times walking the better part of 36.
Yeah.
So I want to be in a shoe that I'm really, really comfortable in.
Has the ping pong table ever gotten like too heated?
We had a guy this year in the President's Cup dive for a ball, and I
I thought you say die.
I didn't hear about that. So it comes off the end of the table, and he goes running across and makes a diving effort on the ground to hit. And I was like, all right, whoa, wait. I'm swearing at the guy. I go, are you absolutely kidding me?
Is Kuchar just heads and shoulders above everybody?
Or yeah, like, you know, he does it without a great serve, too. He just puts the serve in play and toys with everyone. But his volley and getting it back is phenomenal. Phenomenal. He beat me this year. I was joking around with him. I knew he would, but he beat me. He played lefty and beat me. Having fun. I said, I think I can beat you lefty. And he went, no. So I lost a few bucks on that one.
Let's say you just come out Dukes of Hazzard, just dig in this year, just come off that injury, and like you win twice or something on the West Coast swing, and you're playing well, and you start rising up those Ryder Cup standings? Like, would you ever?
It'll be a tough year as far as media wise in that.
Let's just start now.
When I was named captain, I was, you know, that year, earlier that year, I was ranked number four in the world. Yeah. So the idea at the time wasn't that far fetched.
Was that kind of a weird feeling when you're playing that well and it's like, well, hey, come on.
No, I'm still. It was earlier that year. I'd been hurt for a while, and I was asked the question, you know, by some folks, is this a good time for you for the captain, or do you want to, you know, continue trying to make the teams? And I just felt like it was the right time. And now I'm really thankful. I'd been hurt for a while. I haven't been playing, but I really wanted to be, I always wanted to be the Ryder Cup captain at one time in my career. I felt like the timing was right for me because I'm still on tour. I'm somewhat relevant. I can go out there and play practice rounds with, you know, at the time, like this last year, I knew Justin Thomas, but I didn't know him that well. And I wanted to play some with him. I wanted to see his game. I wanted to get to know his personality. There's going to be more young players coming up. Maybe a Xander Schauffele, or maybe, and I hate to name names because I don't like to put pressure on these guys, but there's always going to be young players coming that I don't know very well. And I want to get to know them because it's not only knowing their golf game, but it's knowing their personality and how to pair them up, how they're going to fit into a team, what role they're going to play. And I knew I could do that better before the age of 50, before I was maybe out playing the Champions Tour, still engaged. And I know some of the younger players, you know, now I know Justin well, say Jordan Spieth, Patrick Reed. I can lean on those guys a little bit and say, hey, you know, let's go play a practice round, but let's go get these two guys to play with us, because I need to get to know them a little better. And now I've got a guy that's comfortable with me that can kind of break that ice. And I always wanted that. I wanted to be relevant on tour. And Davis was able to do it at maybe a little older age, at say 53 or 54. A lot of it was because of Drew. I mean, Drew played college golf with Justin. He knew Jordan growing up. So he already had that relationship with some of the younger players that most 53, 54-year-olds aren't going to have.
I like how you very subtly dropped that you're somewhat relevant. I mean, you're one of the few guys. You're one of the few.
I haven't been playing, so it's been months since I played.
One of the few guys who I think can walk into any golf course and everybody's going to know who you are. And it's kind of, I always thought this about golf. It's kind of weird. You know, golf has these superstars that kind of get isolated almost in golf. I'm curious, outside of golf, how much anonymity do you have? I mean, you've done everything in your sport.
Depends a little bit where I'm at.
It still seems like you kind of walk up into if Walmart,
well and win a tournament, it ramps up a lot. But there's still places. My wife's from Columbus, Ohio. We go to a couple of Ohio State games every year, and in the parking lot, 150 people will walk by and want a picture or say hello. I mean, Columbus is a giant golf town.
Right.
So kind of depending where we travel and where we go, I might be in Paris and a random person will walk up, and you know, if it's just Tab and I and the family, we might walk all day for hours, and then a random person walks up and says, you know, takes a picture, and it's kind of out of place. But it's fun. I'm very fortunate in that most of the folks that want to say hello, and it's a nice experience. Fan wants to come over, maybe take a picture, say hello, wish you well, and off I go. I mean, I've never been where I couldn't take my family to Disney or hang out with the kids or have a normal.
You're famous, but you're not too famous.
Well, that's kind of
the right level.
So
fame.
For like a Tiger or Phil, or that's not always possible. They don't go to dinner in peace.
Of course,
if that makes sense. Where I can go to dinner and I may hear my name, like, hey, that's Jim Furyk, because I'm walking by, but. Yeah. We can sit down and have a normal dinner, and I might look around and there may be a few eyes staring at me. But
for the players this year, we were sitting at Nona Blue in Ponte Vedra, and like Jordan and Smiley were sitting over there in the corner, and like, you know, some like 60-year-old guy walks up and just like interrupts the heck out of the dinner and asks for a picture, and it's just like, have some shame, people.
Well, that's
what
I was going to get at, is like, you know, you're kind of one of the few remaining guys of that generation that didn't have social, didn't have all these, you didn't have to put yourself out there in all these like crazy ways to raise your profile and serve your sponsors and do all that stuff. It's like, it seems like kind of a blessing almost to be in that spot.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm now on Twitter because the PGA of America wanted me to with the Ryder Cup.
That's a fair trade-off.
It's been cool. I mean, I've enjoyed it, but you know, I guess I also enjoyed kind of not having to do it, you know, and being a little bit anonymous. And I've always kind of felt like, there's a couple things that are sacred to me. One's my home. So like, if you've noticed, there's rarely, I don't know if there is a picture of me in my home.
We were talking about it before you came in, and I'm like, he's one of the most famous people in golf. Like, I don't even know if he has kids. Like, I don't know anything like about his personal life. It's awesome.
I have a 13 and a 15 year old that are and great kids. My daughter's a sophomore. My son is 13. He's in eighth grade. We have a close family. They used to and still travel quite a bit in the summer. I thought by now they wouldn't want to, but they love traveling because that's what they've always done. And like my home is kind of sacred. Not really. I mean, some folks know in the media and that they know my family and my wife. Now, sometimes we walk in an airport and people, like, if I'm not right there, they'll walk by and they know she's Tabitha Furyk because of the web.com commercial. Exactly. And she was on it. And I've had people walk up and say, you know, I didn't really recognize you, but I saw your wife. And then I looked over and I get the biggest kick out of that. So
she seems like she's busy all the time. Like, not to sound like a creep, but I see her around Jacksonville Beach. Like, she's always
really busy.
Coffee shops.
She runs our foundation for a full-time job. She sits on a lot of boards. She sits on the board of the Baptist Hospital in Jacksonville. I get to go to a lot of events as a plus one. It's kind of cool.
Cocktail parties.
Yes. Yeah. Hang out, have a beer, chat with everyone. It's pretty easy. The plus one job is a really good gig. Just saying.
How'd you meet her?
I met Tabitha at the memorial. So her. Her last couple, 2.5 years of college, she worked for Muirfield Realty. So she worked her way through college there. Her boss at the company loves golf. I mean, a golf freak show, I guess, would be the best way I could say it. Just loves golf, talks it 100% of the time. Back then he did. And he would take a week off of work to work a radio show at the event. So I think they'd plug into him every 20 minutes. What's going on? He'd update scores. He'd go over to like a concession stand or he'd talk to fans and it would be like Mr. Goff, you know, would sign in and he'd say something about what was going on at the memorial. And so my wife's job for the tournament was basically, you know, it's a huge social event. She hung out there with him and his fiance at the time and happened to be there for a few hours. Then she was going to meet some friends later at the tournament. And I was walking off the 18th green after a practice round, and he interviewed me. But while he's interviewing me, I'm checking her out. And I said hello to her, and then he kind of realized what was going on, introduced us. And he loves golf, so he asked if I'd go to dinner with he and his fiance and her. At the time he asked, I actually didn't know which one was his fiance. So then I was very uncomfortable for a little bit that I might be checking this guy's fiance out. But it worked out. We went to dinner a lot that week, and been together ever since.
What favorite question we love to ask people? When was the last time you paid for golf?
St. Andrews. And I don't remember the year, but probably in the last 10 years. St. Andrews, to the best of my knowledge, has no free lunch. So I've always paid when I went there. It was like £85 or 100, and I don't know. It was, but no big deal.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. A lot of fun. The beer's a lot cheaper in the in the pub just to the back right.
That's right.
So, good friend of mine used to own it.
What is the biggest fashion regret you have in your career?
The shirt with the buttons.
I was hoping you'd say that.
That was pretty quick, too. Shirt with the buttons.
I kind of like the shirt with the buttons.
So,
you should bring it back.
It was unique. You know, I have a goofy swing. I do everything different, man. I putt cross hand it. I have a weird grip on the club. I'm looping my swing. Might as well just throw the shirt with the buttons in there.
One of our guys, Big Randy, wrote a piece for our site that's called The Tiger Tax. And in it, he calculated how much money Tiger pumped into the game. And he kind of did a rough economic study. And one of the things we always ask people, too, is we were going to do a part two. We haven't done it yet.
Well, I'll say this before you go there. He cost us a ton of money because he always won. I mean, Ernie Els would have had like 15 more wins if it weren't for Tiger Woods. That being said, he still made us way more than he cost
so
us.
So that's the question is if we were, the second part was going to be, we were going to start invoicing players, say, this is how much money you have to pay a tithe to Tiger.
Right.
How much money would you say Tiger has earned you in your career?
Well, you got to think, when I started playing the tour, a pretty good sized purse was $1.5 million, right? And some of them were only $1 million at the time. $1.5 million. Maybe a major was two. I don't remember. And then
good time to throw in. You made that a was putt for $10 million.
That was 19. That was 1994. By 2000, you know, a pretty good purse was $6 million. Early 2000, less than 10 years, they quadrupled, And a lot of that had to do with Tiger. So, you know, I don't know if he made me four times the amount of money, but probably triple.
Wow.
Double for sure.
Yeah. That's usually the answer we get. It's like Charles Howell said, I owe him half of my earnings probably. So. But yeah.
Oh, I don't owe it to him. I mean.
Not technically.
I mean, I'll go on record right now. He hates to pay a bet, so I don't know how much I owe him back. So.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
I know one of my favorite stories I heard you tell in a press conference a while ago was...
He doesn't lose very often, so he doesn't have
to. Yeah, that's true.
He's not used to it. I remember hearing in a press conference you talking about your first time on the range at Sony. I don't know if you remember telling that story, and if they had never heard it, I was curious if you could kind of give me a refresher on that.
That, yeah, one of my funniest and probably worst feeling moments in my career. So my first tour event as a member, I guess. I played some as a non-member. Okay. But we went over to Sony. Sony's got the smallest range on the PGA Tour. It's tiny. Can't fit anyone on it. Because of that, by Wednesday, there's no grass on the range, right? It's just chewed up. And it's a real sandy soil. It's always the trade wind there is a hard into right to left wind. So I've hit that wind there a lot. And sandy range, get up in the morning. Lanny Watkins is on my left. And I go to hit some balls. And kind of my normal routine would be to grab a sand wedge and just kind of hit some 40 or 50 yard shots. And there was a little pin always short left on the range, which is kind of funny. So I just rake the ball in and I'm talking to my dad. And I go to hit the sand wedge over at the first pin. I'm stiff, real sandy soil. I mean, I hit it really fat. And the sand goes up. And, I mean, I can hear it hitting Lanny next to me. And I'm not quite sure who's behind me because I didn't really pay attention. So as I turn to look, I go, oh, my God, it's like Lanny Watkins, who's one of the more
chippy.
For only being about 5'8", he's one of the more intimidating people I've ever been around. And so I turn and it's Lanny Watkins and I go, and in my mind I'm thinking, oh shit, like I didn't just do that. So I just said, hey, sorry about that. And I turned and looked at my dad. He's back there teaching me and I had this grin on my face like, can you believe I just did that? So I rake another ball in, aim at the same pin, hit it fat again. Sand flies up and it's pelting him. And he's over a shot. Now I'm like, it's hit me. Like, first time I kind of thought it was cute and funny. Second time I'm intimidated as could be. And I didn't know what to say. So I said, you know, like, hey, sorry about that. I tried to, you know, add some light to it. I said, maybe I should aim a little farther right. And without breaking stride, he's over this shot and he just tilts his head up and he goes, that'd be nice.
And
goes in and hits a shot. And So now I reach in my bag. I bypass the pitching wedge because that's probably going to be fat too, right? And I go straight to the 8-iron. I aim it up the net down the right side, and I blade the hell out of it. I mean, I just bone it up the right side because I'm so intimidated. Eventually, I kind of get aiming it right. I kind of get it back to where I'm hitting it solid and feel pretty good about it. But I've told that story back to Lanny a few times, and we've laughed about it quite a bit. He's been great to me in my career. He's really been a lot of fun for me.
Awesome. Well, let's wrap it at that. We kept you for an hour. This was great. Appreciate all the insights and stories.
That was an hour?
That was an hour. Yeah.
I mean, it didn't seem like any more than two.
I got one last question. What do you get at Sun Deli?
Sun Deli is either Babs Best or the Gnarly Charlie.
I've never had either.
So now you got to go. You got to go double meat.
Okay.
Go double meat, and then you go. You have to get the white roll. I mean, the wheat's good, but the white roll. They have the best bread in town. That's my opinion. So
preaching to the choir.
And great folks.
Yeah.
Great
yeah.
folks.
Shout out to Sun Deli.
Always looking for some handouts. Huh?
That's right. Yeah. I don't know if they listen to this podcast, but I need to give them a heads up.
They're more into the BMX biking scene, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
skateboarding scene.
Well, we'll let you carry on with the rest of your day. Appreciate you spending an hour with us, and best of luck with the captaincy.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything.